Hello. This is the Pearson EdExcel International GCSE English as a Second Language Paper 2 Listening Test, Summer 2018. This test is in three parts. You will hear three extracts and will have to answer questions on what you hear. At the beginning of each extract, there will be a pause to give you time to read the questions. You will hear all three parts twice. Write your answers in the spaces in your question booklet as you listen. Part 1. In this part, you will hear a teacher talking about the arrangements for the school's activities week. Listen and complete the notes. Write no more than three words for each answer. One mark will be awarded for each completed answer. First, you have 1 minute to read the questions. Now listen and answer the questions.
Good morning, everyone. For those of you who don't know me, I'm Mr. Mackay, and I'm the coordinator of the school's Activities Week. This year, Activities Week will take place from Friday the 15th of July to Wednesday the 20th of July. Please note that Thursday the 21st of July will be a normal school day. Activities Week is a fantastic opportunity, and every student is expected to get involved as the week is part of the school's curriculum. Here's a brief overview of how this week is arranged. There are two groups of activities, Group A and Group B. Group A activities last for 4 days. You'll need to choose one from this group. For most of them, you'll spend at least one night away from home. This is not the case for the sailing course or the photography workshop, as they are nearby. Both of these will start and end at school each day. Group B activities each last for 2 days. You'll need to select two activities, but you'll do only one of them. The vast majority of these are day trips to local places, although some are entirely school-based, such as the leather workshop, where you can design and make a laptop case or a wallet or a handbag. The baking workshop is another activity which will also take place at school. There are plenty of activities to choose from, and there's a detailed description in the booklet, copies of which can be obtained in the library. Alternatively, go online to the school's website for the electronic copy. I'll hand out an options form at the end of this meeting, and you should bring this to the dining room from 8:45 a.m. on Wednesday the 23rd of March or Thursday the 24th of March. Don't worry about money at this stage, but please note that no one is allowed to hand in their forms before this time. Year 12 students, the arrangement for you is different, and I'll give you details in a moment. After you've submitted the forms, you'll receive a letter via your tutor to say which activities you're on and how much you need to pay. For most activities, the full non-refundable payment is required by Friday the 13th of May. Once you're accepted onto an activity, you're committed to it, and it's vital that you're able to pay the full amount. This is important because staff organising trips need to confirm places and book tickets and transport, and it's difficult to do this if people want to change their choices. If payment hasn't been received by the deadline, you may be removed from the trip. One thing you need to know is that participation in Activities Week is dependent on good behaviour throughout the year. This includes both during the day and on the way to and from school. Students who misbehave may not be allowed to participate in Activities Week, but will be in school doing lessons. Another thing you need to know is that only in exceptional circumstances, granted by the head teacher, will students be allowed to be taken out of school for a holiday during Activities Week. Some students have already signed up to go on a number of particular visits. If you're already going to the rugby tournament in Scotland, or on the music tour to either Austria or Italy, please do not choose another four-day activity, but hand in the form indicating which activity you're already committed to. Year 12 students, you are also expected and required to take part in Activities Week. You have three different ways to participate. You can choose to take part in any of the activities on offer. You can also elect to help with activities which require sixth form help. These are likely to be the free, school-based activities. Lastly, you can choose to do work experience or volunteering during this time. You'll need to arrange this yourself, but you must give me full details of your placement. One important thing you need to know, it is illegal to do any form of paid work during Activities Week. Whichever option you choose, you need to fill in the Year 12 section of the options form. You can collect a work experience form when you submit your options on the 23rd or 24th of March, and in your case, you need to hand this in at the sixth form study area. Let's now move on to
Now listen to the recording a second time and check your answers.
Good morning, everyone. For those of you who don't know me, I'm Mr. Mackay, and I'm the coordinator of the school's Activities Week. This year, Activities Week will take place from Friday the 15th of July to Wednesday the 20th of July. Please note that Thursday the 21st of July will be a normal school day. Activities Week is a fantastic opportunity, and every student is expected to get involved as the week is part of the school's curriculum. Here's a brief overview of how this week is arranged. There are two groups of activities, Group A and Group B. Group A activities last for 4 days. You'll need to choose one from this group. For most of them, you'll spend at least one night away from home. This is not the case for the sailing course or the photography workshop, as they are nearby. Both of these will start and end at school each day. Group B activities each last for 2 days. You'll need to select two activities, but you'll do only one of them. The vast majority of these are day trips to local places, although some are entirely school-based, such as the leather workshop, where you can design and make a laptop case or a wallet or a handbag. The baking workshop is another activity which will also take place at school. There are plenty of activities to choose from, and there's a detailed description in the booklet, copies of which can be obtained in the library. Alternatively, go online to the school's website for the electronic copy. I'll hand out an options form at the end of this meeting, and you should bring this to the dining room from 8:45 a.m. on Wednesday the 23rd of March or Thursday the 24th of March. Don't worry about money at this stage, but please note that no one is allowed to hand in their forms before this time. Year 12 students, the arrangement for you is different, and I'll give you details in a moment. After you've submitted the forms, you'll receive a letter via your tutor to say which activities you're on and how much you need to pay. For most activities, the full non-refundable payment is required by Friday the 13th of May. Once you're accepted onto an activity, you're committed to it, and it's vital that you're able to pay the full amount. This is important because staff organising trips need to confirm places and book tickets and transport, and it's difficult to do this if people want to change their choices. If payment hasn't been received by the deadline, you may be removed from the trip. One thing you need to know is that participation in Activities Week is dependent on good behaviour throughout the year. This includes both during the day and on the way to and from school. Students who misbehave may not be allowed to participate in Activities Week, but will be in school doing lessons. Another thing you need to know is that only in exceptional circumstances, granted by the head teacher, will students be allowed to be taken out of school for a holiday during Activities Week. Some students have already signed up to go on a number of particular visits. If you're already going to the rugby tournament in Scotland, or on the music tour to either Austria or Italy, please do not choose another four-day activity, but hand in the form indicating which activity you're already committed to. Year 12 students, you are also expected and required to take part in Activities Week. You have three different ways to participate. You can choose to take part in any of the activities on offer. You can also elect to help with activities which require sixth form help. These are likely to be the free, school-based activities. Lastly, you can choose to do work experience or volunteering during this time. You'll need to arrange this yourself, but you must give me full details of your placement. One important thing you need to know: it is illegal to do any form of paid work during Activities Week. Whichever option you choose, you need to fill in the Year 12 section of the options form. You can collect a work experience form when you submit your options on the 23rd or 24th of March, and in your case, you need to hand this in at the sixth form study area. Let's now move on to
That's the end of part one. Now turn to part two. Part two. In this part, you will hear an interview with a journalist. Listen and answer the questions. Write no more than three words for each answer. One mark will be awarded for each answer. First, you have 1 minute to read the questions. Now listen and answer the questions.
John Amory, you are about to retire from a long and successful career in journalism. Could you tell me what's been the key to your personal success?
Thank you for the lovely introduction. Well, journalism has always been a fairly risky career, and lately it's been getting even worse with all the cuts being made. Essentially, it was simply luck that whenever I left or was sacked or my paper closed, there was always another job waiting for me.
John, you've received numerous awards over the years. How important is such recognition to you?
Oh, I haven't won that many, and I can't remember ever hanging one on my wall, so I suppose that tells you about their importance to me. Having said that, getting them is a sign of achievement, and it's nice to be recognised by your peers. Sometimes, anyway. Certainly, the best prize I got paid for me to travel around Japan and several other Southeast Asian countries for a month.
So, let's go back a bit. What was it that actually made you go into journalism all those years ago?
Well, at first I wanted to be an artist, or an actor. But my parents had other ideas. They were immigrants and wanted me to go into a profession such as law or medicine. I duly obeyed and started an engineering course. But then a film came out which was closely based on the lives of a couple of journalists. It was hugely popular at the time and it changed my life. And like many other young people at the time, it inspired me to get into journalism.
Oh, did you change onto a journalism course then?
No, that wasn't possible at that time. I switched to English and philosophy and started to write. If I'd been rich enough, I probably would have worked on the campus daily newspaper, writing about student politics or the arts. But I wasn't. Instead, I worked freelance, writing theatre reviews for newspapers in Manchester and Liverpool.
How did that work out?
Very well, actually. In fact, the money was so good, I could afford to pay my way through university. You see, my parents couldn't support me financially, so I had to find a way to make journalism pay. And it did. I was even able to help my parents set up a small business of their own, something I'm immensely proud of.
And what did you do after university?
After university, through contacts of my flatmate's father, I was hired by a daily newspaper in London. From there, I went to the London Gazette, which went out of business 3 years later. I then spent a few years working as a ghostwriter for a politician who was writing a book on government. After that, I moved on to documentaries for a radio station. Finally, I landed a job at The Observer, and I've worked there for almost 30 years.
That is a long time. How did you get to where you are now?
Well, I started off as a lead reporter for the entertainment section and moved on to being the section editor for the money pages. After a while there, I shifted to being the paper's deputy editor, and I've done that ever since. The main focus of my job is the news section. I edit columns written by others, write headlines, and assign and accept contributions from freelance writers.
That's quite a journey. The Observer is a highly regarded newspaper. Do people treat you differently as a result?
I suppose some of the status rubs off and you may have a better chance of getting your calls returned, but don't rely on your organisation to give you status. Organisations become well thought of by hiring good people in the first place. My advice to someone starting out is to concentrate on doing good work, even in sorry surroundings, and try to develop an idea of what you'd like your next move to be.
Thinking about journalism today, would you say a formal qualification is necessary to succeed in the field, particularly if a person is already a talented writer?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. I've known a few extremely talented reporters who never finished university, but having some form of qualification is pretty much standard these days. I used to be dismissive and look down on journalism courses and would probably have recommended studying political sciences or economics or history instead. But these days I am very positive about the idea and would encourage students to take some journalism modules. However, I still believe that journalism is best learned by doing.
On saying that, what are the employment prospects for journalists these days?
I have to admit, becoming a journalist isn't the best choice of careers right now. Over the last decade, even the biggest and best newspapers have been reducing their staff numbers due to competition from the internet. Up until 3 years ago, newspapers made most of their money from companies promoting their products. But the internet is a far more effective channel for this. The industry is currently in decline, particularly the national and international offices.
And what do you think the situation will be like in the future?
Oh, I have no idea. But I suspect within the next 5 years, two major national newspapers will have folded, and there'll be a good deal more original reporting on the internet, once somebody has worked out how to make this business model pay.
And apart from that rather bleak assessment, what is the principal downside of being a journalist?
Well, after quite a few years in journalism, I did reach a point about 15 years ago when I asked whether I could do this for the rest of my life. I came to the conclusion that I love meeting different types of people and learning about the different things I write about in my articles. But I also wondered whether I wanted to deal with the stress that comes with the territory. It took me a while to get to the answer, but I know I would miss journalism if I stopped. It is my passion, and it will always be.
Now listen to the recording a second time and check your answers.
John Amory, you are about to retire from a long and successful career in journalism. Could you tell me what's been the key to your personal success?
Thank you for the lovely introduction. Well, journalism has always been a fairly risky career, and lately it's been getting even worse with all the cuts being made. Essentially, it was simply luck that whenever I left or was sacked or my paper closed, there was always another job waiting for me.
John, you've received numerous awards over the years. How important is such recognition to you?
Oh, I haven't won that many, and I can't remember ever hanging one on my wall, so I suppose that tells you about their importance to me. Having said that, getting them is a sign of achievement, and it's nice to be recognised by your peers. Sometimes, anyway. Certainly the best prize I got paid for me to travel around Japan and several other Southeast Asian countries for a month.
So, let's go back a bit. What was it that actually made you go into journalism all those years ago?
Well, at first I wanted to be an artist, or an actor. But my parents had other ideas. They were immigrants and wanted me to go into a profession such as law or medicine. I duly obeyed and started an engineering course. But then a film came out which was closely based on the lives of a couple of journalists. It was hugely popular at the time and it changed my life. And like many other young people at the time, it inspired me to get into journalism.
Oh, did you change onto a journalism course then?
No, that wasn't possible at that time. I switched to English and philosophy and started to write. If I'd been rich enough, I probably would have worked on the campus daily newspaper, writing about student politics or the arts. But I wasn't. Instead, I worked freelance, writing theatre reviews for newspapers in Manchester and Liverpool.
How did that work out?
Very well, actually. In fact, the money was so good, I could afford to pay my way through university. You see, my parents couldn't support me financially, so I had to find a way to make journalism pay. And it did. I was even able to help my parents set up a small business of their own, something I'm immensely proud of.
And what did you do after university?
After university, through contacts of my flatmate's father, I was hired by a daily newspaper in London. From there, I went to the London Gazette, which went out of business 3 years later. I then spent a few years working as a ghostwriter for a politician who was writing a book on government. After that, I moved on to documentaries for a radio station. Finally, I landed a job at The Observer, and I've worked there for almost 30 years.
That is a long time. How did you get to where you are now?
Well, I started off as a lead reporter for the entertainment section and moved on to being the section editor for the money pages. After a while there, I shifted to being the paper's deputy editor, and I've done that ever since. The main focus of my job is the news section. I edit columns written by others, write headlines and assign and accept contributions from freelance writers.
That's quite a journey. The Observer is a highly regarded newspaper. Do people treat you differently as a result?
I suppose some of the status rubs off and you may have a better chance of getting your calls returned, but don't rely on your organisation to give you status. Organisations become well thought of by hiring good people in the first place. My advice to someone starting out is to concentrate on doing good work, even in sorry surroundings, and try to develop an idea of what you'd like your next move to be.
Thinking about journalism today, would you say a formal qualification is necessary to succeed in the field, particularly if a person is already a talented writer?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. I've known a few extremely talented reporters who never finished university, but having some form of qualification is pretty much standard these days. I used to be dismissive and look down on journalism courses, and would probably have recommended studying political sciences, or economics, or history instead. But these days I am very positive about the idea, and would encourage students to take some journalism modules. However, I still believe that journalism is best learned by doing.
On saying that, what are the employment prospects for journalists these days?
I have to admit, becoming a journalist isn't the best choice of careers right now. Over the last decade, even the biggest and best newspapers have been reducing their staff numbers due to competition from the internet. Up until 3 years ago, newspapers made most of their money from companies promoting their products. But the internet is a far more effective channel for this. The industry is currently in decline, particularly the national and international offices.
And what do you think the situation will be like in the future?
Oh, I have no idea. But I suspect within the next 5 years, two major national newspapers will have folded, and there'll be a good deal more original reporting on the internet, once somebody has worked out how to make this business model pay.
And apart from that rather bleak assessment, what is the principal downside of being a journalist?
Well, after quite a few years in journalism, I did reach a point about 15 years ago when I asked whether I could do this for the rest of my life. I came to the conclusion that I love meeting different types of people and learning about the different things I write about in my articles. But I also wondered whether I wanted to deal with the stress that comes with the territory. It took me a while to get to the answer, but I know I would miss journalism if I stopped. It is my passion, and it will always be.
That's the end of part two. Now turn to part three. Part three. In this part, you will hear a talk on the colour indigo. Listen and complete the sentences. Write no more than three words for each answer. One mark will be awarded for each completed sentence. First, you have 1 minute to read the questions. Now listen and answer the questions.
Indigo is the name of a blue pigment which is used as a dye. It was once so rare that it was called blue gold, but now it's perhaps the most common clothing colour of all. If you wear blue jeans, you're probably a fan of indigo. Much of the world has native plants which produce indigo, and more than 50 different species of plants produce it in usable quantities. The word indigo is also used for all of the plants in the genus Indigofera. Indigo-bearing plants come from families as varied as the bean family, the cabbage family, and the rhubarb family. All natural dyes come from plant sources, other organic sources such as fungi and lichens, and also from the insect world. When you look at them, it's possible to predict the colour provided by these natural sources. For example, the madder plant has red-purple roots, and it's from these that a reddish dye can be produced. Indigo, in contrast, is unique among natural dyes because the colour isn't visible in the plant, and the leaves need to undergo specific chemical processes to produce indigo powder. Most natural indigo dye for sale comes from the leaves of Indigofera tinctoria, a member of the bean family. This plant is tender to frost and thrives in tropical areas with fertile soil. It's commercially grown in India, El Salvador, and Vietnam, among other countries. It grows to about 2 meters tall, has pink or violet flowers, and the light green leaves close at night and open up again at dawn. Forms of the indigo plant can be found in cultures all over the world. It was regarded as a precious commodity because a large number of plants are required to produce a significant quantity of dye. In ancient Egypt, indigo-dyed cloth was used to wrap mummies, and in Rome, it was employed both medicinally and as a pigment in cosmetics. But the earliest indication of farmers growing Indigofera tinctoria was in India. Mentions of it are found in manuscripts dating back to the 4th century BC. When Marco Polo, the Italian explorer, arrived in India in 1298, he documented the cultivation of the plant for use as a dye. When Marco Polo returned to Italy from his trips through Asia, he described how indigo was not a mineral, as had been thought, but was, in fact, extracted from plants. At the time, small quantities of indigo were available from the East, but they were very expensive due to the long land journey required and the tax imposed by traders along the route. Consequently, the locally grown plant, woad, was the main source of blue dye used in Europe. By the 1600s, sea routes to the east were well established. In order to ensure a controlled supply of indigo, large-scale cultivation of the plant was started in India. Vast quantities were exported from there to Europe, and the cost dropped considerably. By the end of the 17th century, indigo had virtually replaced woad in Europe. It was then regarded as an ideal trading commodity, high value, compact, and long-lasting. The Industrial Revolution of the 19th century created even greater demand for dyes as mechanized cloth production grew exponentially. Indigo, in particular, was highly sought after, as it was the preferred colour of military uniforms in several European countries. A shortage of indigo in France during the wars with Napoleon even led to the infantry having to wear white coats. By the mid-19th century, natural indigo production could no longer meet the demands of the clothing industry, and a search for an alternative began. In 1865, a German chemist, Adolf von Baeyer, began working on the chemical production of indigo, and a few years later, synthetic indigo was launched. Baeyer went on to win the Nobel Prize in Chemistry for his work on organic dyes, including indigo. The use of natural indigo declined sharply around this time. The demand for indigo also increased in part due to the popularity of blue denim jeans. In the United States, the rise in cotton production and the availability of cheaper forms of blue dye meant that California gold miners in the 1870s, looking for sturdy and inexpensive work clothes, turned to the indigo-dyed denim overalls and trousers produced by Levi Strauss. The indigo dye gave denim a unique character. It doesn't penetrate cotton like other dyes, but sits on the outside of each thread. The dye molecules are gradually stripped away each time the fabric is washed, causing it to fade in a unique and personal way. Most commercial dyeing now uses synthetic indigo, and in 2015, synthetic indigo production amounted to approximately 60,000 tons. In recent years, there has been increased criticism of the processes used to produce synthetic indigo and their environmental impact. These involve harsh chemical compounds that can be harmful to humans, particularly those involved in producing dyes. The waste from dye factories can pollute local water sources if it is allowed to enter them untreated. Work is currently underway to find alternatives. This has led to a renewed interest in natural indigo, but the world's current production of this natural dye cannot meet the ongoing demand. Today we see blue everywhere we look, and the popularity of indigo in particular shows no sign of waning.
Now listen to the recording a second time and check your answers.
Indigo is the name of a blue pigment which is used as a dye. It was once so rare that it was called blue gold, but now it's perhaps the most common clothing colour of all. If you wear blue jeans, you're probably a fan of indigo. Much of the world has native plants which produce indigo, and more than 50 different species of plants produce it in usable quantities. The word indigo is also used for all of the plants in the genus Indigofera. Indigo-bearing plants come from families as varied as the bean family, the cabbage family, and the rhubarb family. All natural dyes come from plant sources, other organic sources such as fungi and lichens, and also from the insect world. When you look at them, it's possible to predict the colour provided by these natural sources. For example, the madder plant has red-purple roots, and it's from these that a reddish dye can be produced. Indigo, in contrast, is unique among natural dyes because the colour isn't visible in the plant, and the leaves need to undergo specific chemical processes to produce indigo powder. Most natural indigo dye for sale comes from the leaves of Indigofera tinctoria, a member of the bean family. This plant is tender to frost and thrives in tropical areas with fertile soil. It's commercially grown in India, El Salvador, and Vietnam, among other countries. It grows to about 2 meters tall, has pink or violet flowers, and the light green leaves close at night and open up again at dawn. Forms of the indigo plant can be found in cultures all over the world. It was regarded as a precious commodity because a large number of plants are required to produce a significant quantity of dye. In ancient Egypt, indigo-dyed cloth was used to wrap mummies, and in Rome, it was employed both medicinally and as a pigment in cosmetics. But the earliest indication of farmers growing Indigofera tinctoria was in India. Mentions of it are found in manuscripts dating back to the 4th century BC. When Marco Polo, the Italian explorer, arrived in India in 1298, he documented the cultivation of the plant for use as a dye. When Marco Polo returned to Italy from his trips through Asia, he described how indigo was not a mineral, as had been thought, but was, in fact, extracted from plants. At the time, small quantities of indigo were available from the East, but they were very expensive due to the long land journey required and the tax imposed by traders along the route. Consequently, the locally grown plant, woad, was the main source of blue dye used in Europe. By the 1600s, sea routes to the east were well established. In order to ensure a controlled supply of indigo, large-scale cultivation of the plant was started in India. Vast quantities were exported from there to Europe, and the cost dropped considerably. By the end of the 17th century, indigo had virtually replaced woad in Europe. It was then regarded as an ideal trading commodity. High value, compact, and long-lasting. The Industrial Revolution of the 19th century created even greater demand for dyes as mechanized cloth production grew exponentially. Indigo, in particular, was highly sought after, as it was the preferred color of military uniforms in several European countries. A shortage of indigo in France during the wars with Napoleon even led to the infantry having to wear white coats. By the mid-19th century, natural indigo production could no longer meet the demands of the clothing industry, and a search for an alternative began. In 1865, a German chemist, Adolf von Baeyer, began working on the chemical production of indigo, and a few years later, synthetic indigo was launched. Baeyer went on to win the Nobel Prize in Chemistry for his work on organic dyes, including indigo. The use of natural indigo declined sharply around this time. The demand for indigo also increased, in part, due to the popularity of blue denim jeans. In the United States, the rise in cotton production and the availability of cheaper forms of blue dye meant that California gold miners in the 1870s, looking for sturdy and inexpensive work clothes, turned to the indigo-dyed denim overalls and trousers produced by Levi Strauss. The indigo dye gave denim a unique character. It doesn't penetrate cotton like other dyes, but sits on the outside of each thread. The dye molecules are gradually stripped away each time the fabric is washed, causing it to fade in a unique and personal way. Most commercial dyeing now uses synthetic indigo, and in 2015, synthetic indigo production amounted to approximately 60,000 tons. In recent years, there has been increased criticism of the processes used to produce synthetic indigo and their environmental impact. These involve harsh chemical compounds that can be harmful to humans, particularly those involved in producing dyes. The waste from dye factories can pollute local water sources if it is allowed to enter them untreated. Work is currently underway to find alternatives. This has led to a renewed interest in natural indigo, but the world's current production of this natural dye cannot meet the ongoing demand. Today we see blue everywhere we look, and the popularity of indigo in particular shows no sign of waning.
That is the end of the test. Please wait for your question booklets to be collected. Thank you, and good luck.